Okay. Hey, Randy, what's going on?
Jim, it's good to hear from you.
What amazing things are we going to talk about today?
Well, today we're going to look at what I find one of the most fascinating sort of alternative directions for theoretical physics these days is the gravitational alternative explanations to the dark energy phenomenon.
Is there a little more, can we be a little more specific on that? Because I think there are plenty of them.
Well, that's true. We're going to look at two papers this time. One of my favorite astrophysicists, Sean Carroll, wrote a paper in 2003 with some other authors called Is Cosmic Speed Up Due to New Gravitational Physics? And that was actually kind of ahead of its time. A lot of people weren't really looking at this at that time. And then more recently, in 2016, we have a paper by Austin Joyce and others called Dark Energy Versus Modified Gravity, which is like a broad overview of dark energy models and modified gravity models. And it shows how they distinguish between the two of them, which is actually kind of an interesting question. And looks at all kinds of specifics of different problems and different tricks that they're trying to use to solve those problems. So with dark energy now being like a thoroughly proven phenomenon, the question of its nature is more pressing than ever and more elusive than ever. With some new work going on with Dark Energy Survey and a bunch of other projects, hopefully we'll be able to quantify dark energy better, see if there's anything anisotropic going on there. And in the meantime, it's good to have like theoretical models waiting in the wings for the next experimental observations, you know?
So we want to figure out what's going on with dark energy and what are the sort of candidates that we're going to look at?
Well, this the first paper talks about a form of FR theory, which we've discussed before, which is actually a very simple FR theory. Sean Carroll and the other authors propose just adding an exponential term to the Ricci scalar.
So he's got this 1 over r term in the action, and you're saying that turns into an exponential term where?
Doesn't he put an n exponent on the Ricci scalar, and then he looks at the consequences if n is less than 0 or more than 0?
I think there's a little bit of that. He starts out talking about that, but really what he wants to do is he wants to talk about this 1 over r or the 1 over r to the n model. Most of the paper, I think he's talking about 1 over r, and then he throws in the 1 over r to the n towards the end of the paper after he's talked about some really cool stuff. I think he's talking about the r to the n stuff because people had already been looking at the r to the n stuff prior to 2003, trying to figure out a reason for inflation. Whenever you have this additional term on top of the square root of the gravitational constant times the Ricci scalar in that integral for the equation, in that Lagrangian, you're able to show why there's this excessive expansion of the universe at early times. But what he wants is to try to show why the universe is accelerating right now. That's what we want to explore, is what is making the universe expand according to the cosmic microwave background, according to large-scale structure stuff and all that other stuff. What he's done is he's just put together the next simplest FR theory, which is add a 1 over R term. Then later on, he does the 1 over R to the N stuff. You know, that's just where he starts. And that gets you, if you massage, you know, constants just right, something that looks like the acceleration that we think we're seeing right now coming from a gravitational theory rather than from a dark energy theory.
Yeah, and he creates a new mass parameter, mu, and fine-tunes a result in order to see if he can get the kind of scale of dark energy effect that we're seeing now, and he did. And it's a very small number. I guess this would be, perhaps has something to do with the energy content of the vacuum, but he chose a parameter of mu at like 10 to the minus 33rd electron volts.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what that mu is. But other than that, yeah, I mean, you need to have some sort of constant sitting right there in the equation. So you have that there, and then just as a fitting parameter, he's chosen 10 to the minus 33rd electron volts, because otherwise the world doesn't work right.
With what he's doing here, using different modifications to the same factor, he's able to model both the inflationary epoch and the current era where we have dark energy starting to show up. But the weird thing is that you'd need different values for that parameter. And he doesn't offer an explanation of like what would make that parameter evolve, which would be a really interesting causal mechanistic concept.
So you remember when we talked about FR theories in the ancient past, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the reason why the author of that review paper on FR theories in general was so interested in looking at two-term FR theory. One was R squared, which is the next thing up from general relativity. and the other one was a 1 over r term. I think that's the reason why he was looking at both of those, is because that way you can have that r squared term in the modified gravity, which gives you the acceleration. And by the time it gets to the current era, that term is negligible. Then he can also have that 1 over r term, which is negligible up until right about now. So yeah, just by adding those two terms together, you get what you're looking for in a theory. Now, obviously, you've got a really interesting idea there. What if this FR parameter is somehow changing in time? I don't see any really good reason for that to happen, and I don't see anybody trying to do that. It does sound a little hard.
Yeah, but I guess when you look at it, the conditions were extremely different. I mean, between the inflationary period where it was just all energy and where we are now. So it seems like there'd be some kind of parameter involving maybe, I don't know, density or something like that, energy density or something like that, would allow you to evolve that term, but there's no physical connection that I've ever seen that would do that, you know?
In at least one of these papers, and probably the other one, they were talking about modifying that W parameter that's in the equation of state, saying that that might change during the evolution of the universe. So that W parameter is basically the ratio of the pressure in the universe over the matter density. And so, and because that thing's changing in time, that can change the way your gravity is working.
In a previous conversation, you'd pointed out that Einstein field equations, they're like the minimum energy, the simplest form of the metric tensor theories for gravity, right? So what I found interesting in this paper is he points out that maybe the universe in its current state, or maybe a little bit in the cosmic past where there was no observable dark energy, maybe that's just like a special case of a larger theory, and we just happen to be in an era where dark energy isn't very strong and, you know, in general relativity holds to our observations. I liked that because it reminded me of how Newtonian physics is like the weak field limit of Einstein's theory of gravity.
Yeah, there might be something to that as well. And there's something else that we're going to talk about later that has a limit for gravity. And so, I mean, if there is a modified gravity, then it's highly likely that general relativity is a limit to that. Because, I mean, if we just look at what these parameter values are that we can measure, it looks like general relativity is the correct theory. Everything else seems to be, even if it's not strictly violated, is looking more and more tenuous, really. If you look at how things are supposed to act, they don't act that way. And so you end up with some fairly strange things having to happen for your theory to still be viable at this point, if it's not general relativity.
Yeah, because as I understand it, everything that's more complex than general relativity has an additional force, like a fifth force quality to it. And so in order for our observations to fit with that theory, there'd have to be some kind of screening mechanism for that fifth force so that we wouldn't observe it, you know, at normal scales and distances, right?
Exactly. So there has to be something like that. And that's a big part of the next paper, the second half of the podcast.
Right. And those look kind of contrived, but so does dark energy.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, I think dark energy wouldn't look so contrived if dark energy were doing what we'd expect it to do. So, I mean, the big problem with dark energy isn't that we see something like dark energy. The problem is we see so little of it. I mean, just an amazingly small amount compared to what we should be seeing. So that's the question, right?
Yeah, why is it so small and not zero, right?
Yeah, we say it should be due to these vacuum fluctuations. That makes perfect sense. QED guys say we like vacuum fluctuations, so we're good with that, right? But then it's, you know, 55 orders of magnitude too small, at least according to the Carroll paper. And I was just reading a book by Isaac Bars, and he was saying it's 120 orders of magnitude too small. So I'm not sure why.
It's where they put their cutoffs, you know, like they kind of have arbitrary cutoffs on what the limit for a highest frequency energy is, I think.
Yeah. So but in any case, it doesn't really matter.
It's still way the hell off.
Yeah. And so the real question is why so little? And even if it is why so little, if you say, well, there shouldn't be any of that vacuum fluctuation stuff, because some people say that, then you're stuck with, well, why is there any at all, right? So you're stuck twice.
Yeah, exactly. You're stuck on both ends. Just for reference, people can look up the cosmological catastrophe. that's where that comes from, this huge disparity between quantum mechanical predictions using vacuum fluctuation and dark energy. But, you know, we've done a couple of interesting episodes about the Casimir force, and we've seen how it can be derived without vacuum fluctuations at all, which stunned me, frankly. I mean, all of my favorite physicists still love the idea of vacuum fluctuations permeating all of space and having all this energy wiggling around everywhere. But here we find that you can derive that force without any reference to it. And so, you know, it appears to be an artifact of perturbation theory. And so that would mean that there would be no vacuum energy at all. But where I had a question about that, didn't when they just discovered the Higgs boson, doesn't that mean that there's a Higgs field everywhere?
Yes, there should be a Higgs field everywhere. I don't want to talk too much about that because it's a little bit weird. You know, the usual sort of bosons have something to do with local effects. The Higgs boson has to do with global effects, as I understand it. And the problem with that is I don't understand what that really means.
Yeah, but I thought of the Higgs boson looking at these papers because, you know, it's apparently presented as a universal scalar field, and now we have experimental detection for it. So I was thinking, I wonder what the energy of that scalar field that they say is universal, I wonder what that energy density is.
I'm sure if it was anywhere near what was needed, you'd have heard about it.
Yeah.
But that is a good question. It's a good question to ask with all of these fields that are running around. What really should we be seeing with each one? But I don't have the answers to that, and neither do these papers.
Well, it's future work. Hopefully we'll get some answers. You know, I'm really praying that we're going to see some kind of causal connection in dark energy. Like, so far, it appears to be exactly linear. It just increases with distance period, and that's all there is to it. But that really is unexciting and kind of troublesome from a physics point of view, because everything else that we know in physics has some kind of direct mechanism.
Well, I mean, that's the whole problem with all these dark things, is they look like they're really constructed to work with the data, but they don't really give you a good idea about what they really are. I mean, same thing with, like, WIMPs. So now you have non-bosonic matter, whatever that is.
Yeah, something we've never even been able to detect, and it's supposed to be freaking everywhere, 10 times more prevalent than matter.
It's good to look at it. We should look at it at some point. And I think I saw couple of papers that are up on the website. Now, you have looked at the website since I've categorized the suggested shows.
Mm-hmm.
So it looked really nasty the first time I showed it to you.
Yeah, it was just a long list.
I've started categorizing that a little bit. And you or anybody who's listening to the podcast can just go to Physics FM master feed, find that suggested shows link, put a suggested show up there, possibly with some papers.
Oh, nice. So people can just make a comment and we can have an idea.
And I've got at least one dark energy and one dark matter thing sitting up there already. So you can take a peek at those and see if either of those strike your fancy or if you can find something else that you might want to sort of add to that.
Okay.
But yeah, I don't have a lot to add about the gravitational attraction of the Higgs field.
Fair enough. In this paper, this Sean Carroll paper, he talks about three distinct outcomes depending on the value of phi.
What is phi?
Phi is a scalar field, right?
Yeah. Is that the same phi from the other paper, you think? It looks like the same phi.
I assume so, because they're talking about the same type of theories, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the same type of theories, and in some places, the equations using phi are the same equations. What they called that in the other paper was a field condensate of the cosmological constant. So I'm not really sure what a field condensate of a cosmological constant is.
See, that's the thing, is I wanted to ask that same question. I was like, wait, the whole idea is that it's like isotropic, so how can it be connected to a condensate? But they did link it to dark matter, and they said that it like co-evolves with dark matter in some way. So it's almost like maybe they're saying that the vacuum expectation field between galaxy clusters changes as the dark matter evolves within that system?
Probably. I mean, there's a lot of stuff like that going on in that other paper.
I really like the idea of coupling the two dark things together. That'd be really nice and elegant if you could solve both, like Dragan Hajdukovic has tried to do.
Well, I mean, yeah, it would be nice if all the dark things were all one thing.
Suddenly illuminated.
At least if there were two things going on in the universe that were sort of perpendicular, orthogonal to each other. It would be nice that they were connected, and that way, you know, the dark matter and the dark energy are sort of like matter and energy to us. Just living a orthogonal life.
I guess that comes in a little bit in these brain theories that come up, because they're saying that there would be another dimension of space in these brain theories that could explain why gravity appears to leak out of our universe at long ranges.
Yeah, that's in the next paper. It's interesting. And yeah, it would be great to get to that. But I think we were just about to talk about this eternal de Sitter stuff, right?
Oh yeah, that's right.
So we were just about to talk about the three different ways that the universe evolves.
Yeah, depending on this value of phi of this mysterious, I guess, scalar field aspect of the gravity equation that he's looking at.
I mean, that's interesting. So the thing there is that you're taking some initial phi, which is initially very small. Now, this might not mean anything, but it's much smaller than the Planck mass. And the Planck mass is, you know, 4.3 micrograms. So you take the entire universe and you turn it into something that weighs less than 4.3 micrograms. That's your initial condensate. Then it's supposed to evolve, and it evolves depending on what its initial velocity, its initial rate of change is, whatever that means in, you know, four-dimensional, seven-dimensional, 23-dimensional space, whatever you like. So it has these three different things, right? The eternal de Sitter state is what happens when you have just enough of this change in this condensate so that when you go from basically zero potential at, I think it's, you go from zero potential at the beginning up to the maximum potential, and you just sort of sit right there at the maximum for the universe or whatever this potential really is supposed to be. If you just sit right there at the top of that thing, that I think really only occurs in these FR theories, or at least in the scalar tensor theories of gravity, then you get this eternal de Sitter state, this eternal de Sitter universe, which is just, you know, accelerating universe, right? I think that's what it is, this exponentially accelerating universe, which is what we're supposedly just starting to do right now.
Okay, so the idea for this is the eternal de Sitter space means that if this is this, if this is the right scenario, then the universe is going to just eventually blow up in a big rip.
I'm not sure if that's what this is saying, but I mean, it's saying that it asymptotically evolves to the de Sitter solution, and it just sits there as long as nothing perturbs it. Although, I mean, this is sort of the weird thing, like, what is perturbing the universe, right? But other than that, it's just going to get up to that maximum potential. And when it gets near there, you're just going to have this cosmic expansion.
Okay, like a steady rate, basically, or a steady acceleration, I guess that would be in that case, right? He did say that in this example, the universe asymptotically evolves to a de Sitter solution. If the potential is increasing, then I assume that I associate that with an acceleration at the cosmological scale, right? So it's like that potential would increase to a certain magnitude of like repulsive acceleration. That's what I thought. And then it would just kind of maintain that density, energy density.
Possibly. I mean, possibly it would just have a constant curvature, because I guess that's what the de Sitter solution is it's a constant curvature space with a positive curvature. A negative curvature is an anti-de Sitter space.
Now, what is that like? What's an anti-de Sitter space like?
So I'd say that the de Sitter space would be like living on the sphere. That means that the negative curvature space would be like living in a...
like a black hole.
Maybe something like that. So one would be like a Riemannian geometry, like living on a sphere. One would be like a Lobachevskian geometry or Poincaré geometry, which is sort of inverted. It's sort of just the opposite as far as the curvature solutions are concerned. So instead of having zero parallel lines through any particular point, you probably should have an infinite number of parallel lines going through every point. So it's a sort of hyperbolic geometry.
Okay. So if your initial scalar field is greater than that critical value, then he talks about a power law acceleration.
So what can happen is if you have enough of an initial expansion, you pop over the top of that, right? You pop over that maximum. So basically, it's sort of like rolling a ball, right? You could roll a ball up a hill and it could just stop on the top, or you could roll it too fast and it'll go back down over the other side, all right? And if that happens, then you end up with this power law acceleration, which gets you the scale parameter increases faster than linearly, T squared power law inflation. And that has a equation of state parameter of about minus 2/3.
Now, the Hubble law acceleration that we see now, that's a linear acceleration, right?
I think it is. So all of the things that I see for the Hubble law acceleration only include a single derivative, in A. This one, you wouldn't be able to stop with a single derivative in A.
Then he talks about the future singularity idea. I guess this is a recollapse concept.
Yeah, so if you don't have enough initial expansion to get all the way to the maximum, you just fall back down to the original state.
It slumps down to zero.
Yeah, which in this particular solution is not a very nice place to be. There is a singularity there, and so it's like a big crunch or something.
The thing that he enjoyed about this idea is that a really small correction to the action can produce dramatic long-term effects. That's kind of neat, because it's like that's what we're seeing, and it's a subtle tweak, saying here that in a certain form, it leads to this late-time self-acceleration effect that we're seeing now.
all those things he was talking about, the way he was looking at this is in the absence of matter, which is a kind of strange way to do it. But apparently they all show up with some sort of matter. In fact, I think the matter greatly affects the initial acceleration, because that matter potential is huge compared to this sort of mu squared times the square of the Planck length. So he didn't really say what that means. He said that all of them are available, but he didn't say anything about the likelihood, I don't think.
I'm getting the impression that theorists find it convenient to model the universe as free of matter at this point in cosmic history, because the matter density is so small that it can sort of be disregarded for a first pass.
I think this is supposedly potential dominated. I'm not sure if that means very much. I think that you can't neglect the matter. I think it's on the order of the pressure, isn't it? I mean, if you're saying that W is equal to minus one, then the pressure and the matter are supposed to be on the same scale. I did read something about issues about that, but I don't remember exactly what it was.
Well, I do remember reading one of Sean Carroll's articles about dark energy, and he was saying that it's kind of counterintuitive to use the pressure idea, because people are like, well, if it's got a negative pressure, which like is a it's like a suction force, then how do we end up with a cosmological acceleration? And I guess within general relativity, that pressure without mass, without, you know, without matter, has that quality of a vacuum expectation value that bends space-time the other way, which is interesting. It's really neat that general relativity does permit solutions for what's essentially anti-gravity, negative gravity. You know, it's fully consistent with that if you have the right setup, but it would have to be a form of energy that, which is unlike anything that we know, because all of the forms of energy that we know have an inherent mass energy, which creates a positive gravitational field. It's like phantom energy. What's up with that?
I don't know what's up with the phantom energy.
With the next paper we're going to look at, Dark Energy versus Modified Gravity, which came out in 2016, they talk a bit about... Sorry, I'm just totally having a brain fart.
So with the next paper, which is Dark Energy versus Modified Gravity, that's going to tell us something about expansion. Is that what you wanted to talk about?
Let's just start off by talking a little bit about how they go about this, which I thought was interesting, because it calls in what we were talking about in just a really recent previous episode. Is they use the strong equivalent principle to distinguish between dark energy and modified gravity. As we had discussed in a previous episode, the strong equivalence principle is the idea that no matter what the composition of a body, including its fields and gravitational fields and everything else, that they will obey the gravitational acceleration laws that are the same for test bodies. And no matter where your experiment is done or the velocity, there'll be an invariance. And so it doesn't really matter what the source of the gravitational field is. So there's a violation in one and not the other, right?
Yeah, what this is saying is that you've got these two things, which is modified gravity. You're modifying your gravitational theory, or you can have dark energy.
And if you modify your gravitational theory, then you're violating the strong equivalence principle, right?
Yeah, I think they start out with a really good operational way to make a distinction. And that was that if you're modifying gravity, you're somehow modifying the left-hand side of the Einstein equation, which is G equals T. So you're modifying that G. If you're modifying dark energy, you're modifying the stress-energy tensor. You're saying this stuff goes in this stress-energy tensor, and then all the math happens on the other side that makes everything equal to the stress-energy tensor. But with modified gravity, what you're doing is you're saying, okay, instead of just my metric, just my one gravitational field, what I do is I add in at least one other field. That gives you this fifth force. So their proposed distinctions, they have two different things, the modified gravity and the dark energy, and they have two different ways to look at it. The first way is whether or not this obeys the strong equivalence principle. And like you said, modified gravity violates the strong equivalence principle. Dark energy, the strong equivalence principle is valid. The other equivalent way to look at this is to say whether or not there's a fifth force. So if there's a fifth force, in modified gravity, a fifth force is viable. If a fifth force is not viable, then you don't have modified gravity. With dark energy, the fifth force can be void. You don't need the fifth force. So I made a little table here. I have modified gravity and dark energy as columns, and the strong equivalence principle and the fifth force as rows. And for strong equivalence principle and modified gravity, I put V in for violated. For the strong equivalence principle and dark energy, I put a V in there for valid. For the fifth force and modified gravity, I put a V in there for viable. And for the fifth force and dark energy, I put a V in there for void. So that's helping me a lot in understanding this.
Oh, good. I like that.
Yeah, so I've got V, 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 V.
Yeah, that doesn't confuse things at all. I was wondering if you used a capital on one or, you know, how do you...
That's pretty much the distinction. The strong equivalence principle, it's conjectured that there are no other theories of gravity, metric theories of gravity, that satisfy the strong equivalence principle than general relativity. And therefore, since all these other metric theories have to have an additional non-metric field, they have to have that fifth force, which also means they have to have a fifth force carrier.
So it would be different than the graviton, or does that, because I saw that they talked about maybe giving a tiny mass to the graviton to get some effects. So maybe, I guess it could be one or the other. There'd be a different particle, or the graviton would be a little different than we think.
I think in the end, if you have a fifth force, you need a fifth force carrier. And really the only viable candidates for a secondary field are a scalar field. So it looks like you'd have to have some sort of scalar boson on top of your tensor boson for your gravity.
But since we can't detect a graviton, we certainly can't detect another form of gravity particle, huh?
And these other gravity particles, they're even harder to detect because all of them would have some sort of mass. And that's going to give you a problem.
Well, it's at one point they were talking about how if the graviton had a mass, I guess if we were surprised by it, like we were with a neutrino, that gravity would fall off faster than the inverse square, which might look like dark energy.
Possibly. So I think what that really is it's saying that if gravity has a mass, then you're able to hide the effects of the scalar boson. I think when they were talking about this mass, you know, if it has a mass, gravity has a mass, then you have a Yukawa potential, which has an exponential drop-off. This is what happens with, like, W and Z particles and stuff like that. So that at some point, if you have a massive object, those fields just turn off. So that sort of saves any odd gravitational theory you have, because that secondary force, at least, has that Yukawa potential, then it's possible that you have a screening effect in place that outside of your body, you can't actually see this fifth force.
Oh, I was wondering how they were able to isolate the screening effect to a very thin skin around the surface of a massive body, and that's how they do it.
Possibly. I'm a little confused about that. I was thinking that the screening happens at the barrier because that's where the changes in the mass density, but I'm not sure about that, at least in this paper, which is a review paper, so it's going over a lot of things very quickly. I'm not really sure about exactly how that works. And it works differently, actually, in three different models, right? This is another place where they have three different models of things. You know, they have one model where the screening potential is sort of based on the force, one where it's based on the acceleration, and one where it's sort of based on, well, maybe the jerk. It's sort of on the third derivative. It's not, because it's a spatial derivative, yeah. So it's more like a density, but it's a spatial derivative of the acceleration. So anyways, that's sort of what you get. You have these three different types of things that could happen. And one of them works with the FR theories, right? And that's that first gradient screening, the one that sort of acts like the force, the Newtonian force at the boundary. So when you have a high force, one of three things could happen. The coupling to matter could weaken. The mass of the field could increase. The gravitational field, the mass increases at that point, right? So that sounds to me like that point is the source of the screening field. And a third possibility is the self-coupling between the fields becomes large. That second type, that acceleration screening, that happens in, like, camouflage, right? Or is it camouflage?
Chameleon?
Or quiescence?
Oh, I thought you were talking about these,
Well, the first one is the chameleon type screening.
Right.
The last type is sort of the massive gravity type screening. And there's this middle one, which is sort of like camouflage, which has something to do with quiescence, which has something to do with the modification of quintessence, I think. I think that still has something to do with a mass in the dark energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does.
So, anyways, that second type has to do with some sort of acceleration screening. It has something to do with kinetic self-interactions. So it has something to do with how things are moving around and how things interact because they're moving around. And the last one, that one that it's the second derivative of the potential or the gradient of the acceleration or whatever that means, that is sort of a massive gravity thing that happens at high density rather than high mass. And that happens with Galileans and stuff like that.
I looked up Galileans somewhere. That was a new term. It said that it's a scalar field whose action is invariant under Galilean transformations. So I guess that's the idea of sort of an all-pervasive scalar field. It's no matter where you are.
I'm thinking that that means the Galilean is that second field that we're talking about. And that invariance of the action would have to be the sort of the theoretical justification for having that. You're saying, okay, this is a new symmetry of nature, or a new symmetry of the field at least. And that symmetry gives us this Galilean particle.
Okay. It's a little confusing to hear us talk about different particles when we're looking at modified gravity theories.
That's not because of us. That's because of Joyce. So it's all Joyce's fault. You know, one of the big things about string theory, right, is that it's trying to incorporate gravity as a particle. And that's what all of these particles are string theoretic particles that do the same thing as the fields in the modified gravity that we've been talking about previously, where we're just modifying the equations of general relativity. In this case, they're trying to find specific reasons for each one of these effects. So each field is associated with its particle. So there are all these different kinds of fields that can do similar things that are based on the local symmetries and things like that. And they have to be mediated by a particular particle, otherwise they don't work.
I see. We're taking a standard model look at gravity here.
Although, I mean, some of the ideas are weird. I think the weirdest one is that something that's really, really massive, like a black hole, doesn't have that second gravitational charge, right? So the black hole is supposed to not have whatever it is that modifying gravity, or it's not supposed to react to whatever's modifying gravity.
Oh, because they're like inversely proportional, and the stronger the gravity, the weaker the secondary field becomes.
Something like that. I mean, again, in this paper, it's not talking a lot about that, but it is saying that there's this no hair theorem, whatever the hair is, that says that secondary field doesn't affect anything.
Oh, yeah. That
for a really massive body like a black hole or a neutron star.
Right. The no-hair theorem has something to do with the fact that you can quantify all the properties of a black hole with a very limited number of factors like angular momentum and mass and what else? There's a charge, maybe. One of the things that I found interesting that they mentioned was the symmetron model. And this is in the scalar tensor models that we were looking at, like the Brons-Dickey theory. It says that symmetron model is about the vacuum expectation value of the scalar depends on the local mass density. So I don't understand the nature of that coupling, but it was interesting to think that local mass density would affect how we perceive the nature of space itself.
Well, I mean, it's possible to look at space really as only relationships between things.
But if that's true, then is there any vacuum expectation value?
Yeah, we're at sort of a point where we have to start figuring out what the vacuum is.
Yeah. Like, I can't wait to see some of my favorite heroes, like Frank Wilczek, address this question, because it's coming up pretty loudly that, you know, we really need to know, are we even thinking about this right? Are the quantum fields in the vacuum or aren't there? I haven't seen really a good debate with some of the most respected minds in physics yet on that subject, and I'm eager to see it. Because with all that new work being done on the Casimir force, it's just suddenly a really important factor is being questioned.
Yeah, and that's something we'll start looking at soon, is we'll choose some vacuum theories.
Maybe we should write to Frank Wilczek and be like, hey, here's a couple papers that we were going over recently that seem to completely abolish the idea of a quantum vacuum. Do you want to talk about this?
Yeah, I'm sure a dozen letters a day, a dozen emails a day from people who want to talk to him about.
To talk about stuff.
Random stuff.
He seems like a nice guy. He was giving some kind of talk at one of the universities, and he said that he really enjoyed people participating in submitting questions and that kind of thing. So maybe we could luck out. I'd like to hear what he has to say.
Well, sort of put together a good question and ask him if we can read his answer on the air.
Inquiring minds want to know. Come on, Frank, call us up. All right. And so after talking about all these different types of scalar fields and their screening mechanisms and their exotic properties and everything, and it is troubling the lengths that you have to go in order to hide that additional gravitational field at scales that we could measure. because all of our tests don't see it. That is troubling. I don't know if it's more troubling than the idea of an inexplicable energy to empty space, but it seems like we're stuck with one or the other. Then they talk about massive gravity and brain worlds, and that we touched on that before, how there's this idea postulates that there's like a fifth dimensional bulk space-time.
So they are talking a little bit about maybe there's another dimension, and if you have that other dimension, then basically the gravity leaks out into that other dimension. So near a particular star, let's say, everything looks like general relativity. In the solar system, everything looks like general relativity works. But as you get farther and farther away, some of that gravity leaks out into that fifth dimension, and it doesn't look like general relativity anymore, which is a reasonably interesting thing. I'm not sure how you detect it or figure out that that's really happening, but I mean, it's a reasonably interesting idea.
Yeah, this harkens back to the talk that we had about Isaac Barrs and his idea that there were six dimensions to space-time. There was another dimension of space, and there was another dimension of time. And he did that wonderful work which showed all these beautiful symmetries between seemingly unrelated phenomena. If that six-dimensional space-time has to conform to a certain gauge symmetry, which projects the apparent observable universe that we see in four dimensions.
I guess in that particular case, he postulates a symmetry that requires two time dimensions, as well as one more spatial dimension, and that everything that we see is sort of a holographic projection of a six-dimensional object instead of a four-dimensional object.
Right, kind of like a shadow on a wall.
Yeah, that's the way he put it, but it's not really a shadow, because it's sort of holographic. And the way he means holographic is that all the information in the sixth dimension should be available to you in our four dimensions. But what the object appears to be depends on its sort of orientation in that sixth dimension.
That's a fascinating and mind-bending concept, because I remember him showing how completely like unrelated phenomena at different scales and with different properties would actually be just two views of the same object in the six-dimensional universe.
That's sort of the way that is supposed to work. It's a little strange. I'll say that for it. It's a little bit strange.
It's amazing to me that he was able to figure that out. Like, this guy's brain is unreal. Isaac Barrs is like such a freaking genius. I remember seeing him speak very casually in front of a room full of like other PhDs, and they're all like straining and holding their heads and like struggling to follow. So I didn't feel too bad being lost at many points when he's talking about the most abstract aspects of theoretical physics, as if he was talking about, you know, having breakfast with his kids. I mean, this is amazing. So let's get on to these screening mechanisms. They're saying that the new degrees of freedom will have to be introduced to general relativity to explain the dark energy effect if we don't go with the dark energy model. And so in order to be consistent with our observations, you need these screening mechanisms. And there's several forms of them. I think you touched on them earlier. There was screening at large field values, where the additional degree of freedom develops a large expectation value, causing the coupling to matter to weaken and the mass of the field to increase, or the self-coupling of the field to become large, which leads to a diminishing of the force mediated. So the examples of this are the chameleon field, the symmetron, and the dilaton.
Yeah, so that's sort of the FR theories and scalar tensor theories do stuff like that.
Yeah, and here's the part where you're talking about the accelerations. There's another one, screening with the first derivatives. And that mechanism turns on when the local gravitational acceleration exceeds the critical value.
What's interesting is that these first two screens, the gradient and what they're calling that first derivative, they both are looking at the same parameter, the gradient of the Newtonian potential. And then one is greater than the square of the cosmological constant, and the other one is just greater than the cosmological constant. That's another wonderful thing about people and doing a lot of theory, is that they hide all of their units in definitions. And so it's hard to figure out exactly what they mean. But yeah, somewhere I decided this was like an acceleration. So yeah, we've got these different kinds of screen. What was so interesting about the screening things? I've got a whole page of rewritten stuff for that. Saying, you know, this chameleon field, the symmetron, the dilaton, those are critical mass screenings, right? So if you have a really massive body, they basically turn on. But then if we look at these Weinstein fields or Weinstein situations and the Galileons, then you have a critical density that screens the nonlinearities in your equations. And that does something a little bit different. I mean, it's fairly interesting looking at these plots that he put out there, right? Where you can see in the chameleon fields basically things turning off, and you can see for the massive gravity for the Weinstein fields, things are either screened or they're not. and they just stay that way. And the numbers are small for the chameleon fields. The largest number they have is, you know, 4/3 of G, right? 4/3 of the gravitational acceleration that we expect is sort of the maximum without screening. And, you know, they've got one of these for this parameter in the FR theories that they derive that you just see it turning off. Turns off over a couple of orders of magnitude, I think. So it goes from 4/3 G down to 1 G. Whereas, again, with the massive gravity, you know, again, either you're screened or you're not. And none of those are actually at G. Self-accelerated bodies, the weak gravity with the D graviton, that shows up with an acceleration of less than what we expect. And then they have these other two bands, these bands that have gravity that's greater than normal. Those have sort of the size of the cutoff. And the interesting thing is the size of that cutoff is a ratio of the fourth and fifth dimensional masses. These things have a mass in four dimensions and a mass in five dimensions, and there's a ratio or something that does something with them, and I'm not sure what.
Holy tamale. One of the questions I wanted to ask, though, is maybe you should finish your point first. Oh, I'll ask.
Well, no, I don't have any.
The thing is that I keep thinking when I'm looking at this stuff is it's absolutely essential. The reason it's important to talk about the screening mechanisms is there's no way to have a change to the general relativity equation. Like, you can't change gravity without having some kind of screening mechanism. So it has to be there one way or the other for these models to work.
You shouldn't say it's impossible. It's just that based on experiments, the constraints on modifications in a metric theory, different metric theories, are very, very stringent. They've just gotten more and more stringent. You have to look and see if there's something in the nonlinear regime of that theory that would hide something in the linear regime, because all of these experiments are analyzed in the linear regime. And I think only gravitational waves don't need to be. Only gravitational waves need to be fully nonlinear. Everything else is in sort of a weakly nonlinear position as far as what they can do with these gravitational experiments. With these observational things, you only get masses that are so high. And so you only see weak nonlinearities. You don't see the really strong nonlinearities. But when you make those approximations to make the math easy and to be able to figure out what you're seeing, and actually to even be able to compare these different theories. So in this, they use something called the parameterized post-Friedman model. And that is sort of like the parameterized post-Newtonian model, only it's a little bit simpler and it's sort of focused on what he wants to talk about in this paper. But in either of these cases, they're just extrapolations of general relativity from the Newtonian limit. So the screening mechanisms, at least for the FR theories and probably for most of the theories that are worth talking about, are not things that are added onto the theory. They're an artifact of the nonlinearities that you're pushing out when you're doing the post-Newtonian analysis.
Oh, so they fall out naturally from the mathematics?
Yes, at least for the FR theories. And that's where you're getting your chameleon effect from the FR theories, is from the nonlinearities, or at least that's the claim. I haven't done that.
But here's the thing. I guess maybe this is an unfair question. Have we ever seen anything like a screening mechanism like this in nature before? Or it would only operate in this tensor level of mathematics?
I don't think so. These are coming from the nonlinear effect. It may be from other nonlinear systems you can see something similar, but I'm not sure what they'd be. What acts like a screening mechanism might be something that's very different from a screening mechanism. You know, the last time I was sitting at the coffee shop reading a book on nonlinear dynamics, I didn't see anything like a screening mechanism.
It would be neat if there was some kind of physical analogy so we could get our heads around it and try to figure out what would be an intuitive solution.
I mean, it would be nice to know exactly what was going on, but I think they're sort of doing their best. Do you know exactly how these halos are associated with this?
I saw in the paper that the quintessence model seems to conform, they say, within 5% to the halo model of dark matter. And I'm assuming that they're talking about running long-term cosmological computer models of the aggregation of dark matter into those like halos that they talk about, like around the galaxy. Apparently they've been able to show the quintessence model of dark energy somehow, that we were talking about before, somehow follows this, I guess, condensation of dark matter.
Yeah, because I mean, they keep talking about these halos, and in fact, these graphs we were talking about earlier were about acceleration deviances in dark matter halos. You know, they're looking at the gravitation versus the mass, and the mass is estimated about whatever dark matter with halos and stuff like that.
Yeah, so I think what they're talking about here is this, when they model the formation of structure from the Big Bang to now, and I guess they're seeing a very close correlation between the rate at which dark matter are aggregated around the galaxies and the magnitude of the dark energy effect, you know, within this quintessence model.
Anyways, I don't have much more of an idea about what's going on with this stuff than that. Exactly where it's coming from and what a good analogy for it would be. Because it's not like a Faraday cage. Because there's not a thing there. There's no nice grounded bunch of metal that can keep your signals out. I'm not completely sure what you could model that as.
At the end of the paper, they talk about, there's a bunch of what looks like more than half a dozen different big collaboration experiments that are seeking to get more data on the dark energy effect to try to get a more granular look at it. I think the dark energy survey is going to start coming out with results soon, maybe as early as 2018, I think I read somewhere. So maybe we can start to see if there's any anisotropies in the field.
Possibly we'll be able to do a show on that next year.
You know, I had a crazy idea before we got started after I was reading these papers. It occurred to me that all of the galaxies are emanating, you know, mass in the form of photons constantly. So if you have two gravitating bodies separated by a large distance, so their gravitational attraction is already very weak, and you've got the Hubble expansion on top of that, if you've got two bodies that have dropping mass, their scalar mass is dropping every second, wouldn't that introduce like a weak gravitational term that would look like the gravitational field is falling off faster, and therefore it would look like an acceleration away from each other when you've got like the Hubble constant put into that equation?
Yeah, I mean, it should look like something like that, I think. Yeah, I mean, if you pretend that keep having the same mass, or in some sort of equilibrium when they're not really in equilibrium, then that's exactly what would happen. And because it's dark at night, I think you can assume that, you know, like a galaxy is losing energy all the time.
And so I was wondering, you know, would it be possible to do like a really simple, even like Newtonian calculation to see if it's at the right order of magnitude to explain the dark energy effect?
Well, you can try. It should not be completely difficult. You know, why don't you make this your honors paper for this semester?
Thank you, Professor Ranchler. I think I might do that just to see what comes out. Just to see if it's like in the right order of magnitude or if I'm off by like 40 orders of magnitude.
It would change from galaxy to galaxy, right?
Yeah, but you should be able to get it.
Because they each have different luminosities, but you should be able to figure out the rate of mass change.
Yeah.
Right? Mass or energy flux and therefore mass change, right?
Right.
So, yeah, you shouldn't have too much of an issue.
All right, I'll give it a shot. I guess that's all I had for this show today.
Well, that's good, because it's getting really, really late. And you know, I'm living in the suburbs now, so, you know, they shut off the power. Because everybody's asleep, they don't even need to keep it on.
Electrical curfew, look out. All right, Jim, I'll let you go. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, nice talking to you, Randy.
You too, Jim.
Bye now.
Bye.